Welcome to Sunday Vibes Extra Time, the podcast brought to you by our friends at Now TV. Stream on the go with a Now TV Sky Sports Mobile Month Pass for just £5.99. You'll get unlimited access to five Sky Sports channels, including Sky Sports Premier League, directly to your smartphone. To buy your Sky Sports Mobile Month Pass for just £5.99, go to nowtv.com.
It's extra time.
He shoots and it's a goal!
Hello and welcome back to the first Extra Time podcast in 2 weeks. Sorry we kept you waiting, but it's going to be an absolute corker. Today, we're doing Wonder Kids that have gone off the radar. Where are they now? What have they been up to? Who knows? Joining me is Joe Tomlinson and Doogie Critchley. Then, of course, Hello. We will be doing Rose Ed and Facts with Rafa Benitez. We'll round off the show.
Okay, I'm bringing to the table one of the most renowned failed Wonder Kids in world football, I think. It's the Manchester United superstar that never was, Ravel Morrison.
Ooh, a lot of requests for him. Crowd pleaser.
A lot of requests. And I think a lot of people kind of know the story. They know bits and bobs about the story of Ravel Morrison. They've heard that he was a decent player, but don't know too much detail about Ravel Morrison. So I thought I'd flesh him out a little bit because we have to go back 10 years to start this journey, back to when he first signed his professional contract, aged just 17 in 2009. And of course, he went on to be part of that 2011 FA Youth Cup winning Manchester United side that was pretty bloody good. That obviously featured the likes of Paul Pogba, Jesse Lingard, Michael Keane playing at right back then as a sort of marauding right back overlapping, which was a very different Michael Keane to what we see now, where he's quite static at the centre of Everton's defence.
Yeah, putting it nicely. I remember a quote from Rio Ferdinand about that team as well, with the likes of Pogba and Lingard in, where in he said they looked up to Ravel Morrison as the fulcrum of that side.
The leader. Yeah, Ravel Morrison was amazing. But Manchester, this was a Man United sort of glory period, really. The 2011 was one of the best years to be a Manchester United fan. You had the FA Youth Cup winning side. Man United reached their third Champions League final in 4 years. Of course, getting battered by Barcelona in the process, 3-1. But I remember the semi-final, we beat Schalke 6-1 on aggregate. I looked at the team beat Schalke 6-1 on aggregate, but they'd beaten Inter 7-3 in the quarters. They'd battered Inter. And the United team that lost, that beat Schalke in the semi-final 6-1, the second leg where we won, I think, 4-0, the rotation is insane. Get on this for a Champions League semi-final winning side. Smalling, Johnny Evans, O'Shea, Raphael, Anderson, Fletcher, Darren Gibson, Nani, Valencia, Owen. How much rotation's in that side? And United will get into Champions League finals with that. Obviously, also the year that we knocked Liverpool off their perch. So a very good year to be a Manchester United fan. And that Youth Cup side was sort of being held at a similar level, not quite as highly esteemed as the class of 92. It was full of geniuses, players like Paul Pogba, who were getting national acclaim for some of the goals he'd scored and his ability. And like you said, Ravel Morrison was arguably the best player in the team. They beat Sheffield United 6-3 in the Youth Cup final. Ravel Morrison got two, far and away the best player on the pitch. And that was a tough run to that Youth Cup final as well. Remember, we beat Liverpool away from home. I think Paul Pogba, of course, got sent off in that game. It was an unbelievable match. I think there were four sendings off, and Pogba got sent off for stuttering on his penalty. Second yellow card, he got binned. And I think Ravel Morrison got the winner, which is like a 30-yard volley into the top corner. And
as you do.
He was just ridiculous in that youth side. And I pulled together some of the quotes from some people that were watching him around that time. And they are incredible. Sir Alex Ferguson, this is the best young player I've ever seen. And he's seen some decent players. I mean, Ryan Giggs, not too bad. Scholes, not too bad. Beck's, not too bad. Gary Neville, his talent was a scandal. He was better than Paul Pogba. He was like Gascoigne. Not a bad quote, given that he played with Gascoigne. Paddy Crearand, obviously Manchester United legend and commentator for MUTV. The best youngster I've seen since George Best. Rio Ferdinand, I would have paid to watch this kid train. This is how good he was. Ferdinand
Textbook
actually,
building him up there.
Yeah, Ferdinand actually goes on to say in that quote that he joined in with some first team sessions when he was 17, Ravel Morrison, and was just taking the piss. He was just taking the ball around people like they weren't there, nutmegging everybody on the pitch, and senior pros started to get a little bit annoyed of him because he was just untouchable. Couldn't get near him. But
we all saw those backheel volleys, didn't we?
Yeah.
Circulate around Twitter.
I know. It's just ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. But off the field, problems were starting to mount up. And it was something that went through Ravel's childhood, didn't have the happiest childhood. And then, I believe, 2012, 2011 maybe, he was convicted of intimidating a witness in a knife point robbery. So this is where troubles start to show. I think Career End actually said that Ravel was really like a nice guy, very intelligent, but grew up with the wrong crowd. And when you grow up with the wrong crowd and you're earning a lot more money than everybody else, they kind of try and stick with you. And I think Ravel always struggled to move out of that crowd. He was then found guilty of criminal damage, sent on a domestic violence course after allegedly attacking his girlfriend. He then used the F word, the homophobic slur, and was fined £7,000 by the FA for that homophobic slur. So that you can
was
see
that
this sort
a
of
game or
on Twitter it was
on Twitter,
on Twitter.
Which doesn't really
doesn't make it any better, but.
Doesn't really justify Kieran's statement that he was very intelligent, but
no, okay. It doesn't, of course. But equally,
perhaps just immature.
I think you can see that he's got a lot of off the field troubles. So as great as he was on the field, his off the field troubles were holding him back already at this stage. But he's still playing like a genius in the youth teams. You know, Sir Alex Ferguson is clearly desperate to make him work.
Yeah,
clearly desperate to get the best out of Ravel Morrison. I think if it had been any other player at this stage, he'd have gone from Manchester United. He'd had, what, three or four chances, and Sir Alex Ferguson has stuck by him because he was that talented. If he had 10% less ability, he probably would have gone aged 18, but he didn't. He stuck with him. And even for the England under 21 side, you can see how much of an impact he had. He's the best player at the England under 21 side. Gareth Southgate, obviously back then the England under 21 boss, he said that he couldn't get over his level of ability. And this is like Gareth Southgate, who's seen some pretty talented England players come through in recent years, isn't he? His level of skill is outrageous, he said. And obviously the goal you talked about, the back heel in training. If anybody's seen that Wesley Schneider finish for, I think it was Inter Milan in like a training session pre-game. Well, this is arguably even better from Ravel Morrison. That went viral and people started to talk about him again as if he was going to blow up. But in the summer of 2012, Sir Alex Ferguson thought, you know what, the best thing to do for Ravel is to get him out of Manchester. He said that he needed to move away from some of the connections he's made here, so he decided he was going to sell him, and he sold him to West Ham United for £650,000, rising to £2.5 million based on performances. I think they were getting 25k per performance, Manchester United as well. Of course, this was the same summer that Man United sold Paul Pogba to Juventus, or let him go, / he was taken. So we lost Ravel Morrison and Paul Pogba in the same summer.
I'm surprised it was such little money as well. That is,
what, 650k?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think his contract may have been running down a little bit, and Manchester United just thought it's best for Ravel if he moves on now, because they're hoping he can get a fresh start in London. And it's kind of the tale of two paths, you know. They both left in the same summer, Pogba and Ravel, but they've both gone in polar opposite directions. One has gone on to become one of the biggest world superstars. One has gone on to become a bit of a nobody, really, which is quite sad given that Ravel was arguably the better player. And when he went to West Ham, Sam Allardyce was pretty shocked by his ability. I think he mixed it with the first team straight away and was pretty instantly one of the best players in training. But again, problems off the field started to hamper him, so Sam sent him out on loan to Birmingham. Again, more off-the-field problems at Birmingham. Senior pros got together and basically said, look, we don't want Ravel Morrison here. He's turning up to training late every day. We're not happy with his attitude in training.
So moving him away from Manchester,
yeah,
for him then to come back, you know, the other way, almost half the way back.
Yeah, well, he's gone to Birmingham, so not quite. Yeah, yeah, so sort of Midlandsy. But he's turning up to training late. So Lee Clark, who was back then the Birmingham manager, put in a sort of emergency meeting with the senior pros and Ravel, and they hashed it out, and actually turned around for Ravel. He was playing really well. He was a key component of Lee Clark's midfield for Birmingham, scored a few important goals, and then went back to West Ham. So at this stage, he's doing really well. He's sort of getting back on track. He's turned his fortunes around a little bit at Birmingham. He's gone back. He's been recalled by West Ham. And he starts off that second season at West Ham flying. He scores on his full debut versus Cheltenham Town, his Premier League debut against Everton. And then he gets that genius goal against Tottenham Hotspur at White Hart Lane, where he picks the ball up in his own half, dribbles past Vertonghen, dribbles past Mike Dawson, and then chips Hugo Lloris. And at this stage, Sam Allardyce realises he's got a gem on his hands. And at this stage, is when Ravel Morrison's career takes another downward turn, but this time it's out of his own hands.
Right, okay.
Is effectively where I got to in my research today. So at this time, he's flying pretty high. He's the fittest he's ever been. He's scoring goals. And Allardyce tries to persuade Ravel Morrison to sign for agent Mark Curtis. Now, Mark Curtis, a pretty notorious operator in the lower leagues in English football, has signed a lot of players and has been in a fair amount of trouble for signing players illegally and taking some backhanded payments. I think he received a payment or a dodgy payment for getting Jermaine Pennant.
Does not sound like someone that Big Sam would mix with, to be honest.
I think he took a dodgy payment.
Why is he recommending him?
Well, I'll tell you in a minute, Dukes. Let's face it, Sam's not the most reliable guy, is he? So effectively what happens is he says, you should sign for Mark Curtis. Mark Curtis puts Ravel an offer, and Ravel says, I don't want to sign for you. I've already got an agent. I'm playing really well at the moment. I'm settled. Let's leave it at that. He's immediately dropped from the squad by Sam Allardyce. So Sam Allardyce is accused at this stage by Ravel Morrison of, you know, pressurising him in training to sign for Mark Curtis in order to keep his first team status. It's not the first time this has happened. It also happened allegedly to Kevin Kilbane. A very similar thing happened alongside Mark Curtis and to a few other professionals, allegedly, anyway. And he has completely denied this, Big Sam.
Yeah.
Ever since he's denied it. And, you know, Ravel has said that he wasn't happy with how he was treated at West Ham. But then the England scandal broke, where, of course, he was sacked after just 67 days for that video that appeared online. He was then investigated by the FA, wasn't he? And during that investigation, his links to Mark Curtis started to appear, in that a number of his squad were signing with Mark Curtis whilst he was a manager. Mark Curtis had helped broker a number of deals for players to and away from his clubs. And that is when Ravel Morrison tweeted, I think he tweeted saying, no one listened to me, ..
Yeah.
And this is 4 years later. And of course, Ravel is no longer at West Ham at this stage. And Sam Allardyce has sold him and he's moved away. And I think...
bit of sympathy for him in that regard.
So I think in this regard, you can see a little bit of sympathy, because this is a player who's just starting to get his career back on track. And as far as I could tell, from the reading, he seemed to get derailed by off-the-field issues that were kind of out of his hands. So that was a bit sad. He's then loaned to Cardiff and QPR, never really works out at either of those clubs, despite scoring a few goals for QPR. And in January 2015, again, off-the-field issues come back to bite him. He's sent to court to face charges of alleged assault, threatening to throw acid in his girlfriend's face and kill her mother. However, all of these charges are then dropped by the Crown Prosecution Services after it is proved untrue. So he's got a lot of issues off the field, Ravel. He's also got a lot of feels on the field at West Ham at this stage because of the Mark Curtis / Big Sam issue. So he decides to sign a pre-contract with Lazio to try and get out of England. He moves over to Lazio in July 2015 and he starts, yet again, like he did at West Ham, with a bang, 2 goals and 2 assists on his debut for Lazio. And and one fan site
bang claimed, is understated. One, that's crazy.
Yeah, one fan site actually claimed that they had the next Gascoigne on their hands.
Gascoigne coming back.
I mean, didn't last particularly long.
The spectre of Gascoigne.
Stefano Pioli, who was the manager then, claimed his attitude stinks. Ravel struggled to learn Italian, and it all sort of fell apart at the seams there when he just couldn't learn Italian and wasn't the best in training. So they loaned him out to Atlas, which is where he probably played some of the best football of his career at about 24, 25 years old.
In Mexico,
one of only two English players to ever play in Liga MX, which is a nice little one.
Oh, who's the other one? Can we get it?
No, you won't be able to.
No?
I mean, I'd never heard of him.
Celtic sold Mark Crossas to
The other lad is called Antonio Pedroza.
All right, yeah. well, you got that? Nope.
Cruz Azul signed him in 2013 from Crystal Palace.
Okay,
big move.
So, yeah, a relative unknown. But, you know, he did all right in Atlas. 25 appearances, 8 goals, 2 assists. He was averaging nearly 4 dribbles per 90, which is pretty decent. And he talked about how he really liked playing in Mexico, how the football suited him. You know, everything's on the ground. It's quite physical. He's really good at riding a tackle. And he was playing so well, he tried to get a call up for Jamaica. So he went to Jamaica and he said, look, I'm going to register my nationality here because I think he's... father is Jamaican, don't quote me on that. And Jamaica manager Theo Whitmore attempted a call up, but Atlas failed to respond to the email, so he didn't get in the squad.
Oh, come on, Atlas.
So that's yeah, yet another case of Ravel Morrison struggling.
Let the man play for two. Yeah,
off the field because of things out of his control. So he goes back to Lazio. Lazio don't really want him, and now he's in a big limbo. He's 26 currently at the time of recording this podcast. Lazio are either going to cancel his contract or they're going to let him go for free. But he has been training with Ostersunds, of course, Graham Potter's old side, the man who left in the summer for
Swansea.
Must
still be a strong English connection there, then.
Yeah, there is a pretty strong English connection. So the manager they hired, Ostersunds post Graham Potter, is a man called Ian Birchall, who was Leeds University Met coach.
All right.
And then went to Viking in Norway, which is a massive Scandinavian side. Did get the sack from Viking. I think it was probably a bit of a tall ask going from Cardiff Met to Viking.
Beat Chelsea in the Champions League qualifying time.
Yeah, and he got sacked there. Although the fans were fuming he got sacked. I think it didn't get given enough time or something like that. So Ostersunds have hired him straight away and taken him to replace Graham Potter. So he is now training out there. I think they're training in Magaluf at the moment. So I don't know whether that's the best area for him to be in. Ravel Morrison. But nevertheless, he's training with them and it looks like he's going to sign for them, which would be good because you know that most years they're in sort of Europa League, Champions League contention at some stage. We saw them do okay against Arsenal last year under admittedly Graham Potter, and I think they
beat them in the Emirates, mate.
I think a lot of people thought they were going to fall away, didn't they? But I think they're still fourth in the league, something like that. So there's been a considerable drop off.
He's back in the talk,
but he's at least back in the talk. But he's 26 now, and I think a lot of people think he's fallen well off the radar. He's completely gone. You know, he's still playing professional football. He's still playing at a fairly decent level.
Doing a fair bit of travelling.
Doing a fair bit of travelling, which is nothing against his name either, because you know maybe he's trying to escape some of his troubles that have dogged him throughout his entire career. So I like to see that. It's just such a shame because this is the player who's called the best young player Ferguson had ever seen.
Better than Paul Pogba.
And in 2017, when Paul Pogba was returning to Manchester United for £90 million, Ravel Morrison was being sent on loan to Atlas in Mexico. So a tale of two career paths splitting, but equally, I'd love to see him do well at some stage. I know he's had a bunch of off the field problems, but sometimes it's how you're brought up, isn't it? And I think Ravel Morrison was partially extremely unlucky and partially shot himself in the foot. But a sad tale of a wonder kid that should have been and never was, Dukes.
Love it. That was excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm going for a wonder kid that was actually more of a 90s wonder kid. So he's actually well over retirement age. Now he's 38. He's completely settled down now. But everyone will know in the 90s that watched 90s football about how popular this guy was. It's Neil Lamptey.
I've literally never heard the name. I've never once heard the name.
Yeah, fair enough. He's on all those lists of failed wonder kids. And he's actually got the saddest story. If you think Ravel Morrison's story is sad, wait till you hear to this. So
Neil Lamptey's quite uplifting, so you know this complements it nicely.
Yeah,
so
definitely. We can finish on a nice uplifting note. But Neil Lamptey was born in Ghana. He's born in a port about 25 miles away from Accra, which is the capital city. And to say he had a miserable childhood is a massive understatement. His parents basically abused him as a child, neglected him. His father was an alcoholic who used to burn him with cigarettes if he misbehaved, and lashed him as well. So he basically saw football as a massive release. It was sort of his refuge. He frequently missed school, which is vitally important that you remember that later. He didn't have a good education as well at all. And he used to find refuge on the football pitch, and he developed at an incredible rate, despite the fact his alcoholic father would often be abusing him from the sidelines. When he was 8, his parents divorced, and his stepfather then threw him out of the house. He went to a Muslim football camp where, in order to qualify for it, he had to convert from Christianity. That created more issues with his family. He basically had a really, really difficult upbringing. But despite all this, he was getting a name for himself in Ghana in the national youth setups. At the time, he was playing for a team called the Young Corners in Accra, but he wanted to move abroad and test himself. But the Ghanaian FA saw that he was the next big thing and basically withheld his passport from him because they wanted to build the Black Stars team around him. This is pretty unsurprising, considering at a youth tournament in 1989, Pele had labelled him as his natural successor after watching the Under-16 World Championships in Scotland. When Lamptey was just 14 at the time. So he'd played that well at youth level that Pele was like, this is my natural successor.
Who was the other lad that Pele did that to? And then there's a photo of Pele holding him like
Freddie
a
Adu.
Newborn
Freddie
baby. Adu, yeah. So this is the Ghanaian
this
Freddie Adu.
This is the Ghanaian Freddie Adu, but it's actually a much sadder story. And Pele, it's harsh to say he's got a lot to answer for, but he does have a lot to answer for in this case, big time. So at this stage, Lamptey wants to move out of Ghana and go test himself abroad, but he doesn't have a passport. So he was then smuggled into Nigeria in the back of a taxi in the footwell, going across three borders by a taxi driver to meet up with Nigerian centre-back and captain Stephen Keshi, who had heard of his skills at youth team level and was playing at Anderlecht at the time. Keshi then persuaded Lamptey to travel abroad as an illegal immigrant and join him at Anderlecht, giving him a fake Nigerian passport and making Lamptey pretend that he was his son. So,
oh my God.
So he arrives at Anderlecht. Everyone's heard of him because of his performances at Ghanaian youth level. And you know, Anderlecht aren't quite sure that it's actually Lamptey. So the entire club comes to watch his first training session, including the club president. But in his own words, after two or three touches, they realised it was me. And since then, he was signed by Anderlecht on a five-year contract. Anderlecht basically then applied to the Belgian Pro League to get the legal age that players could play at reduced so they could start Lamptey. He was that incredible.
But that is crazy. Did Anderlecht at no stage say, surely they're breaking the law by employing...
Yeah, they must have been.
So at this point, he really needed someone to step in, do the right thing, just bring the truth to the surface. And
he was playing under his proper name, though. It was just the Ghanaian FA didn't know.
The Ghanaian FA didn't know, but then if he's there as a legal immigrant, did he actually seek asylum through the proper means?
To be honest, I'm not quite sure. In the articles that I read, it didn't go into that. Right. But he was accepted as a youth product, and it didn't seem like they'd broken too many laws, but they must have. Anyway, so he made his senior debut for Anderlecht at 16, becoming the youngest player ever in Belgium. He scored in each of his opening five games.
He scored five and five.
In that first season, he scored 7 goals in 14 games as a 16-year-old. That summer, he went to the Under-17 World Cup, where Juan Sebastian Verón and Alessandro Del Piero...
Who did he represent?
Ghana. I'm quite confused about how this works.
Yeah.
It was pretty unclear, and it was, you know, in paperwork in the late 80s, so I'm not quite sure.
The process of getting there involved him being temporarily Nigerian, but then everything came to light, and he went...
He went back and they wanted to accept him because they knew his talent.
Yeah,
yeah. But they never wanted him to leave Ghana. I think they were basically performing an illegal act by withholding someone's passport against their will.
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah, so
I think it's more of an issue with the Ghanaian FA than what Lamptey did. But yeah, as I was saying, Del Piero and Verón were at this World Cup, but Lamptey shone. Ghana won the entire tournament at a World Youth Cup at the under-17 level. They topped the group, before they beat Brazil. Lamptey scored an absolute beautiful volley from about 30 yards in that game. They then beat Qatar, and then they beat Spain 1-0 in the final. Lamptey scored 4 goals in 6 games. He was given the Golden Boot, along with Brazil's Adriana, who scored 4-4. And Lamptey won the Golden Ball too, so voted best player.
Bloody good company, isn't it? Adriano.
Not bad, is it? And in 1991, he was voted as Africa's 5th best player, and he was only 17. So this is special lad. At this stage, he then gets called up to the senior squad, starts against Togo in a qualifying game for the African Cup of Nations in a front three of Tony Yeboah, who is obviously well known amongst Premier League fans for those beautiful goals for Leeds, I should say. And Abadi Pelli, who was at the time playing for Marseille. And he then plays for the under-20s at the 1993 FIFA World Cup. They lost on penalties to Brazil in the final. At 1992, he goes away to Barcelona for the Olympic Games. They win a bronze medal. And these are all with Lamptey at the centre. So by the time he was 20, he basically brought more success to Ghanaian youth sides than had ever happened before.
Yeah.
So we've got to then ask the question sort of what went wrong at this stage. It all looks set up. He's at Anderlecht. He's played well for Ghana. He's making a name for himself at Anderlecht. But he basically got completely exploited. He was mistreated by his agent. So his agent was a guy called Antonio Caliendo. And he was the football agent then. But he then became the owner of QPR between 2005 and 2007. And this is when QPR were up to some dodgy, dodgy stuff. He then sold it to Flavio Briatore and Bernie Eccleston, the F1 tycoons, who he then took to court over unpaid payments like 8 years later. And this was a pretty bizarre stage in QPR's history. Caliendo employed a guy called Gianni Palladini to run the club, who was then threatened at gunpoint in the Loftus Road boardroom. So that shows the sort of chaos that he brought to QPR. But at this stage, he was just a football agent. He was also managing Roberto Baggio and Dunga at the time. He seemed pretty legit. But in 1993, Caliendo started running Lamptey's affairs and basically took advantage of his lack of education. Lamptey couldn't read or write, and he inserted into his contract a clause which said his registration would be controlled by Caliendo. So he basically had complete control over where Caliendo, where Lamptey went in his career.
Mm.
And Caliendo would take a 25% cut of any transfer fee, ever paid for him.
That is so
Lamptey
shocking.
Only found that out 4 years later, by which stage he'd been loaned to 4 different clubs, with the fee going pretty much directly to Caliendo. In the words of Ghana's under-17 manager at the time, Otto Pitzer, Lamptey was treated like a piece of meat by the money men of the game. On the pitch, things
and Anderlecht weren't holding him accountable for anything during this phase. Because even in the 80s, that'd have been a pretty well-run club, surely.
Yeah, definitely. I'm seriously surprised that they allowed such a young, talented product to be taken over by a guy like this. But if he's managing Roberto Baggio at the same time, maybe they don't know what he's doing.
You do sort of forget how amateurish actually football was behind the scenes in the 80s and the
90s. 100%. Yeah. This story is a complete example of that. But on the pitch, things started to deteriorate too. So after 3 years at Anderlecht, where he won 2 titles, he was loaned to PSV. Sounds like a good move. And he completely shone. He scored 9 goals in 19 games as PSV finished third, 10 points behind leaders Ajax, but a pretty good first season. Lamptey was top goal scorer. He scored a brace in the game against Ajax at home. But PSV wanted to buy him, but decided they couldn't reach Anderlecht's valuation. So the following year, Anderlecht, you know, have this absolute wonder kid, and they basically offer him around Europe. I don't know why they don't want to develop him further, but maybe they thought he was more trouble than he was worth with his background. I have no idea. But anyway, at this stage, Ron Atkinson picks him up at Aston Villa.
Oh my God.
So this is a pretty surprising move, swapping the top end of the Eredivisie for Aston Villa, who had just finished 10th in the Premier League. But Caliendo obviously wanted the sort of highest possible commission. So, age 20, he's moved from Ghana to Belgium, Belgium to Netherlands, Netherlands to England, with this reputation as being the next Pele, but you know, hanging over him effectively. And he since said that whilst it was high praise from Pele and it was wonderful to be called that, if he didn't live up to expectations instantly, he was considered a failure. And it wasn't a great year for Villa. They won 2 of their opening 14 games, drawing 4 and losing 8th to leave them 19th and facing relegation. Lamptey then went away on international duty. While he was away, Ron Atkinson was fired and they replaced him with a guy called Brian Little, who'd never heard of Lamptey, instantly put him in the reserves.
No relation to Kevin Little.
No, I don't think so, no. And instantly put him in the reserves. They recovered, avoided relegation, but Lamptey scored 3 goals all season in the League Cup, only made 2 starts and 6 substitute appearances. So this promising career is starting to fall apart.
And he must have felt, I mean, on his own then, you know, isolated.
Exactly. Like, he didn't have good English.
He had to adjust to 3 or 4 different cultures in a very small amount of time. And I suppose going back to what you're saying about the whole Pele thing, having that hanging over him would have been much more prominent back then because people didn't have detailed video analysis, you know, extensive scouting networks. They probably were just hanging off the word or the recommendation of a football icon, weren't
definitely,
they?
Definitely, definitely. And I mean, I've watched some of his highlights for PSV today and he was exceptional. He clearly had all the talent, but he was still exceptionally young, couldn't read or write, didn't speak the language, and was basically being master manipulated by this guy Caliendo. At the end of that year at Villa, he was sold to Coventry, who Ron Atkinson had taken over. So Ron Atkinson was someone who truly believed in him, and he since talked about him in his book that Ron Atkinson was, you know, a real icon for him in England and helped him out a lot. But again, the spell was pretty difficult. He was in an unfamiliar city, again, in a struggling side that only narrowly escaped relegation on goal difference. He only scored 2 goals, again in the League Cup versus Hull City. So at the end of 2 years of Premier League football, he's made 16 appearances, didn't score a goal. And at the same time, he was battling huge family issues. So Lamptey, I only found this out in the last half an hour of my research, so I'm not entirely sure. But basically, he comes from a clan called the Gar tribe in Ghana. And he was effectively meant to be their leader. He was effectively meant to be their king, and he ran away from it. So when he was at Coventry, he was quoted as saying, "My family keep telling me I'm famous and I should become king one day, but that is not what I want. When you're in that position, can you imagine how many problems you would have to sort out, especially when there are 3 million people to look after?" So this isn't just a small tribe in Ghana. This is an enormous deal. So he's been hated by his family. He's been passed around like a bit of meat around Europe, and he's also got this hanging over him that he shouldn't even be there. It all sort of went disastrously with Ghana at this stage too. After reaching the 1992 Africa Cup of Nations, they lost on penalties to Ivory Coast. The golden generation then sort of failed to come through, having, you know, done so well at youth level. And Lamptey became pretty outspoken, which is something that he subsequently regretted in the articles that I've read. He basically calls out the team after a pretty poor showing against South Africa and criticises them. And at that stage, he then only had one cap after that. So he won his last Ghana cap at 22, but he already had 38 caps by that time. So to put that into context, Jamie Carragher has 38 England caps for in his entire career. Steve McManaman and John Stones got 37 in their entire careers, and Stones to the, his career so far. So this is a guy who is really, really experienced and a necessary and vital part of a Ghana side. He then began a sort of complete whirlwind tour of football. He joined Venezia in Italy, then Santa Fe in Argentina. He then got sort of passed around numerous other clubs, and he had some unfortunate times with his family as well. In when he was in Argentina, his third son died of a rare disease. He wanted to go home to Ghana and bury him, but the authorities wouldn't let him. He then played in Turkey and Portugal, managed to finally change his agent, moved to Germany with a second division side. But at this stage, it then got revealed that his wife, who had lost two of their children through disease, their other three children weren't biologically his. So he'd been rearing three children that weren't actually his own children.
Oh my God.
So he's got all this going on at home. He's got all this going on with his personal life. I told you it was going to be a bit of a depressing tale, I'm afraid.
Not even one singular period in his career that's not tumultuous, where he finds consistency on the pitch, where things are okay off the pitch. There's not been one single period.
I'd probably say that, that 3 year spell at Anderlecht was his best. And he also did
and
well
was
at PSV.
And that was when
he was 16, 17.
Yeah, following
then,
being smuggled
so he
into
much, the country. He was pretty much completely wound up by the time he was 22. He then went to China. He actually calls that his happiest period of his career. He then moved to the UAE and retired back in Ghana. He's now retired in Ghana. You know, he's not a big name at all. He now breeds cattle and sheep. He's opened a school to give kids the education that he never got. He's also opened up a football academy. So basically, it's just a horrific tale of a really unfortunate upbringing. He then gets completely misused and exploited by football agents, and shows the and he's also
a big problem in that part of the world. Yeah.
Personal luck as well. I mean, his wife being basically disloyal to him and cheating on him. Two of his children dying. He's sort of one of the great game's great unfulfilled talents. And go and watch some of his videos at Ghana youth level. And there's not many of Anderlecht, but the Ghana under 17 World Cup and then the Olympics 5 years later, he is the standout player in both those tournaments. So it's just a really sad story.
That's one of the most sad footballing tales I've ever heard.
Yeah, sorry to bring everyone down, but I thought it was fascinating.
It's pretty sad.
Bloody harrowing. And like I just kind of said earlier, it's still a massive problem in that part of the world in terms of young, promising footballers being exploited, being given dodgy passports in order to be transported around Europe like cattle, like you said. So hopefully,
there's no more
his story can help change that slightly. Is that the silver lining?
Yeah, I think that's the silver lining. And the fact that he's trying to make a difference to young children now, giving them their education, starting his own.
He'd be a great interview, wouldn't he? Going over to Ghana to interview Neil Lamptey. He'd be a wicked interview. And tell his life story and get some of the footage of him as a youngster. That'd be a wicked video.
That is a documentary waiting to be made, isn't it? Okay, I've gone for a slightly more lifting story.
Lift us up,
please,
Pamel.
Please do.
Doogie's just depressing.
Here it goes.
I didn't need it today either.
I'll do my best. So mine is about someone who also, hit very heady heights at an extremely young age. He's now 20 years old, so plenty of time to get to the pinnacle of the game. And he's actually had a really good last 18 to 24 months.
Okay.
So he's the bright spot in our Off the Radar podcast.
Excellent.
But off the radar, he did go, albeit for a relatively short period of time in comparison to your guys. So I'm talking about Martin Odegaard. And that is how we sort of landed.
Legendary name.
Yeah, how we landed on the... He sounds like a house DJ, waiting.
Yeah, he does.
A career in house awaits him, doesn't
he? Yeah, he does sound like a Swedish house DJ.
If he ever drops out of football, then he will be, dropping. Yeah.
Football manager icon,
dropping
Martin Odegaard.
Fat
Do you remember
beats.
On Football Manager that... I don't know whether you've got this in there about Football Manager.
No, go on, crack on.
So he was obviously very young when he broke through, 14, 15.
Yeah.
And Football Manager wanted him in the game as the number one talent because he was the number one talent in world football back then. But because he was 14, 15, to get onto Football Manager, you have to legally be like 16 to be able to sign the waivers. So they must have had 100,000 tweets at them saying, we want Odegaard, we want Odegaard. It was like trending, we want Odegaard, where's Odegaard on Football Manager? So they said, they tweeted saying, we'll put Martin Odegaard in the game if his dad agrees to it. And like, there was such a furore on the internet to get Martin Odegaard to do it that somebody went up to him in the street, I think, and got Martin Odegaard's dad to hold a bit of paper saying, I'm Martin Odegaard's father and I agree that Martin Odegaard can be in Football Manager. And they put him in, he had a minus 20 potential, and it's unbelievable.
That's brilliant.
I'm Hans Erik Odegaard and I approve of this message. Anyway, we'll get to Hans Erik because he was very influential in the formative years of Odegaard's career, which you could probably second guess as his father. But yes, Martin Odegaard, born in Drammen in 1998. So that's a city of just 65,000 inhabitants where the temperature is currently below freezing in January. So just to give you a bit of an inkling of the conditions that he grew up in. He's always been pretty diminutive in stature, only 5'10" now, which suits his profile as a playmaker. And probably his role as a creative midfielder might be something he picked up from his dad, who scored 56 goals from the centre of midfield, playing for Strømsgodset.
His dad's his agent now,
as well as other Norwegian clubs. Very well, maybe.
I think so, yeah.
So by the age of 16, he really is the darling of Scandinavian football and has already trained with Liverpool. So that's the club he supported as a youngster. He went on a week-long trial there. Bayern Munich, Manchester United and Real Madrid. Ultimately, moving to the latter. Very high-profile move in 2015. It was on everyone's radar, wasn't it?
It was, wasn't it? And I remember him picking up a wage.
Yes, and we will also get to that and why that was a bit of an issue. Yeah, at this point, he's moved for €3 million. So the fee is potentially rising to €8.5 million based on certain conditions. Conditions which are probably...
To Real Madrid this season.
Yeah, conditions which are probably still being met to this point. And at Real, he became the club's youngest debutant when he came on for Ronaldo around the hour mark in a 7-3 victory over Getafe at 16 years and 157 days. So what a record that is.
That is
to
so
have
young.
At the most iconic, arguably the most iconic football club in the world. However, this is probably about as good as it got for his career, or his early career at Real Madrid. Only 2 appearances to date, but we'll pick up on that in a moment. We'll recap Real Madrid in just a second. Let's go back to his childhood, and chronicle his rise to a prodigy. So his dad was also his first coach when he started a team at the local sports club. So that was Drammen Strong, just a leisure sports club, and he added the football wing to that. And his parents and other prominent local figures actually invested €6,000 of their own money to help lay an artificial pitch, which has actually been cited as pretty crucial in young Odegaard's development. So remember, -1, if he's not playing in an artificial pitch, maybe it's got under soil heating or whatever, then he's playing on awful surfaces and might not be able to cultivate the technical skills that he's now known for. He was only 6 at the time when this pitch was built, so quite timely in his development.
Hell of a belief in him.
And by the time he's 11, and this is justified, the belief in him, he's impressing at under-16 national tournaments. So he's soon appearing for Strømsgodset's third team in the fourth tier of Norwegian football, aged just 14. So he's playing with blokes Jeez. At what I can only imagine is a pretty rough and ready standard.
This is Radamel Falcao levels. Remember Radamel Falcao, let's not forget, made his professional senior debut aged 14, apparently.
Yeah, I mean,
really,
he had to wait a little bit longer despite rising through the ranks at Strømsgodset because basically couldn't sign a contract because he was still in mandatory education. So the club wanted to register him when he was 15, like I said. Consequently, because he was still in education, he could only play a maximum of 3 games that season as a registered B-list player. So that was a small loophole that enabled them to, show the fans the future. And he got out there pretty soon thereafter, made his debut against Al Suns in April. Probably butchered the pronunciation of that name. Becoming the Tippeligaen's youngest ever player at 15 years and 118 days. And by the 5th of May, the club were utterly convinced they needed to have him down on a professional contract. So he signed one that ran until the end of the season. So they managed to circumvent these rulings. I think he actually... the agreement was that he trained with a local side where his father was coach for a couple days a week after school, and he still did his education and so on and so forth. But yeah, so that lifted the restrictions on the amount of appearances he could make, and he started turning up pretty routinely for the team. So 11 days later, he scored his first goal in a 4-1 routing of Sarpsborg, becoming the Tippeligaen's youngest ever goal scorer. So already two records to his name at this point. And then 5 days later makes his European debut, albeit just for a 5-minute cameo, coming on against Steaua Bucharest in a UEFA Champions League second qualifying round. So not a massive amount of time there to make an impression on the European circuit, but domestically continues to absolutely murder it. Late July, he's involved in all three goals as the club beats Sandnes, now a second division side. So I don't know if it was Premier at the time. And the media went into a bit of a frenzy as a result, with John Onorisa, titan of the Norwegian game that he is, insisting. So the headline was insisting, not just asking, insisting that he be included in the national side. And well, did John Onorisa wield enough power?
Expectations, yeah, there.
Probably.
Did he wield enough power at that point?
Lovely guy.
Well, no, because then manager Per Matthias Hogmo resisted the urge, and common sense probably prevailed. Although that's not stopped him now. He's got 14 caps, you know, age 20, which is not a patch on your boy, but 14 caps, still pretty solid.
Yeah, it's great.
So he has two further standout games in Stromgodset's charge to fourth place in 14-15. And this is the club that Ronnie Dyler, I think, eventually led to the title. But this was overperforming for them at this point, I think. So he's become a talismanic figure in an overperforming side, assisting all three goals in a 3-2 victory in the run-in and scoring two goals for the first time in a 2-1 victory over Lillestrøm, which is a team I've actually heard of.
Yes.
You know, they have some European pedigree. So he's starting to play really well now against the big boys. He finished the season with 12 goal involvements in 23 appearances, winning Young Player of the Year.
Martin, lovely.
And he soon repaid all the faith they'd been put into him at, you know, local level, earning the club 250,000 kroner when he was eventually sold to Madrid, owing to a sell-on clause.
Okay, so they earn their pitch back.
They earn their pitch back. Yeah, he effectively paid for the pitch that was built, you know, in all likelihood for him. So maybe that will foster the next generation of Martin Odegaard's. You know, it's all cyclical. So Madrid recap, because this is where it gets quite interesting, because this is probably the first and kind of last time that most neutral football fans will have heard of Martin Odegaard. He's popped up recently in the Eredivisie, and that's pretty interesting. I found his numbers anyway, and we'll cover that in a second. But despite sort of frequently training with the first team upon arrival, he features mainly for Castilla, so the reserves that are in the third division, which is Segunda B at this point. He even spends periods out of the Castilla side as he struggles to adapt to his new surroundings big time. So the press start to get on his back, shock horror in Madrid. Absolute circus, isn't it? And after his debut for Castilla in February, the team slipped from promotion candidates. And bearing in mind that Madrid fans are insistent that Castilla needs to get to the Segunda division in order to develop its more prominent talents. Because currently they're in the third division. They have to send all their sort of big names at that level to other sides where they're not necessarily guaranteed minutes.
So they think it's too easy, basically.
They think it's too easy. They're not coming up against good enough opposition. But then two, when these players go out on loan to La Liga clubs or Segunda Division clubs, they're not getting the minutes. Madrid can't force the team's hands to play them because they know that, oh, what are you going to do? Send them back to the third division, Real Madrid. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. They're actually top when he came in, when he made his debut in February. And this was actually after arresting some really bad form. Zidane, not a great coach at this level. getting some difficult press as well. People weren't convinced about his ability to lead this Castilla side to the Segunda division. They ended up finishing mid-table, which obviously coincided with his running the side, which didn't make adjusting to life in Madrid very easy. Then we get some sort of glimpses of his talent, you know, the incisive defence, splitting passes, tidy little 1-2s that he's become renowned for, and the tendency to drift from outright and come in on his left foot. The sort of way he moves, the general aesthetic of his play, and I don't want to overblow it here, but it's very Messi-esque. Yeah, okay. The sort of little drop of the shoulder, the kind of like infinite amount of little touches on the way in with his foot. He's very pleasing on the eye to watch. Shock of blonde hair as well. Kind of looks like Casper Dolberg.
Yeah, he does look a bit of Casper.
And he's grown up. Like, if you look at pictures when he joined Madrid and now, it's like, okay, boy, man. But it's only a three, 4 years difference. So, yeah, I mean, when he scored against, the team is called Baracaldo, in a 4-0 home victory during this period, it's noted that his relief is pretty tangible. You know, he's emotional in his celebration. And from a technical point of view in that game, it's widely remarked and reported that he's on a different planet to everyone around him from a technical point of view. People are saying, oh my, this is why Real Madrid brought him. The kid has got talent. However, things somehow get worse. Castilla lose 4 on the bounce, and he's pretty anonymous in 2 of those games. He goes on international duty, then the team win 5-1 when he's not there, which only adds to the paper's narrative that his presence at Castilla is disruptive. And Spanish paper Diario actually report there's some members of the reserve side that are jealous about his preferential treatment because his contract actually stipulated that he only had to train with Castilla like every other day or something like that, which made kind of betting in, I suppose, a little bit difficult. And like Joe pointed out earlier, he was being paid 80,000 euros a week.
80?
That is absolutely stinking. Like, Man United pay some bad wages, but 80k a week for, what is he then, 15 when they signed him, 16?
That beggars belief, doesn't it? Crazy.
I mean,
his dad did a bit on that deal.
Yeah, you would be a little bit pissed off, wouldn't you? But had you been training with that litany of clubs that I mentioned before, you're going to be demanding, you know, top wages, aren't you? And his dad got it. And then in a game against Tudelano, sort of one of his last that season, he came off with Castilla 1-0 down and the game finished 1-1. And AS gave him a rating of 0. So he's got
lovely guys.
He's got two massive papers in the country really after him. He's a shy 16-year-old Norwegian trying his best to adapt. He's being paid an absolute wad that he didn't ask for. He just wants to play for Real Madrid, the best club. You know, he's gone on record to say, I wanted to play for the best club in the world. But 15-16, and here's where it starts, you know, to turn around. He finds his feet. He made 34 starts for Castilla, although scoring just once. So now his reputation as a wonder kid starts to cool a little bit. Who's going to sort of perpetuate the idea that he's an absolute world-beater, scoring once for Madrid's reserves in 34 appearances, yeah. But November 2016, he's gifted a debut for Real Madrid first side in the Copa del Rey against Cultural Leonesa, which Madrid go on to win 6-1. So probably fond memories on his debut. I don't think he contributed to any of the goals. I'm not sure if he got an assist. I couldn't really find that at the time. But it becomes clear that he needs to go out on loan. And this isn't just confined to him at this point, and this goes back to the point I was making before about Castilla needing to get promoted. There's a host of young Real players in this squad that are in dire need of first team action. So Hakimi, Hermoso, Febas, Valverde, who went to Alaves, I think had a killer season at Alaves, and Mariano, who's now back in the team.
Mariano Diaz, yes, is a Leon.
I think Hermoso's at Espanyol, and obviously Hakimi we know is at Dortmund. So he gets his move, finally. After, you know, more kind of dilly-dallying in Castilla, he gets a move to Heerenveen in January 2017 on an 18-month loan deal, struggling to nail down a first-team place straight away, much to the joy of the Spanish press. Like, we told you so sort of vibes. With only one shot and one assist in his first 7 games. But he does recover to finish the season with 1 goal and 3 assists in 864 minutes, or a goal contribution every 216 minutes. So not
still
that
young.
Yeah, not that bad. Still what? 17, 18 at this point?
Not the best here in Vien team either.
No. Mid-table Dutch side. But great kits, though. I remember love hearts.
Literally,
all over those kits.
Weird. Blue and white with the love hearts. Very individual. Down the stripes.
Remind me of those TY teddy bears. Anyway, the subsequent 12 months in the Eredivisie, though, little bit of a turnaround here, and more so than the actual numbers, the top line numbers would suggest. So 24 starts, 3 goal contributions. Again, it looks like he's not very active. He's supposed to be this decisive playmaker, finding balls in the final third, and his figures don't suggest that until you take a look at the sort of closer numbers. And I read some very good Strata Bet articles on this. None of his numbers run under stat, annoyingly. So it's a little bit patchy, but I put this together as an overall picture. So his expected assist for that season had him closer to 6. So his teammates were effectively wasting these good chances he was creating. And he led the team for chance creation and secondary chances, so second assists. So easily the team's best creator as a now 19-year-old. And he's also, since then, improved at a really good exponential rate. So I'll read you some of his numbers from that first 6 months on loan to that full year at Heerenveen before we progress to Vitesse, where he is now. And that's sort of me done, really. So shots in that six-month loan deal, 1.2. 17-18, jumped up to 2.1. Key passes, 1.5, which is not bad in that 6 months. 17-18, jumping up to 2. Dribbles, 1.2 to 2.8. Average passes, 37 to 45. Tackles, he's down to 1.6 tackles and interceptions. Up to 1.6 from 1.2. So solid progress on all fronts in that 18 months. So it looks like, you know, objective complete. You've become a more well-rounded player. Playing, you know, well in Europe's, what, sixth? Seventh best league, probably. Not sure about the coefficient with the league and Nosh. But there's still areas of his game that are a little bit raw. I mean, he is still 19. His shot map for 17-18 would suggest that shooting is a big weakness of his, and he's been working like that this season. That's pretty noticeable. So he took 35 across the course of the season, all with his left foot. So quite predictable, quite Iron Robin-esque in that fashion. 24 coming from outside the box for an XG of 0.076.
That's not great.
So not great. But now on loan at Vitesse, where he's got 3 goals and 4 assists in 15 starts, with the club 5th in the table at the time of writing, which is a Europa League playoff spot. And I've got to say, apart from maybe Hakim Ziyech, he's probably the best creator in the Eredivisie at the moment, numbers-wise. So not output-wise, but get a load of this. So plays on the right in Leonid Slutsky's 4-3-3.
Oh, is that where Slutsky is now, the dirty old dog? I was wondering where he'd pop up, and he's at Vitesse. Oh, what a man. What a name.
From Hull to Arnhem. You probably see that as, you know, a bit of
from
an upgrade.
Hull
and
to
Macron, are their kit sponsors for Vitesse? No,
are
it's there. Bit obscure. Bit 90s,
okay, that is.
It is
a bit 90s.
Do they sponsor Nice?
A bit quickly, Kevin, that, isn't it?
I can't remember who they
sponsor. Macron. I'd say one of the worst kit sponsors out there, to be honest.
It's got
to
be up there.
Even Hummel have made a bit of a comeback, haven't they? Anyway, so he's been dominating the creative stats at Vitesse too. So 1.1 more key passes per 90 than the second best creator at the Arnhem club. And would you, Adam and Eve, it's left back Alexander Butner.
Oh, he's there. Really? Big Alex. Nice to hear the name, the Butterman.
The Butterman. Right. So he's got the third most key passes in the league on 3.1 per 90. Behind Ziyech and Berghuis. Always struggle with that. Who have 5 and 7 years on him, respectively. And at the end of January, he was leading the chances created charts in the last 7 games. Last 11 games, sorry. I don't know why they've rounded up to
last
11.
Is that the whole Eredivisie or just... just Vitesse.
No, this is the whole Eredivisie. Wow. So leading chances created in the top flight charts. In the last 11 games, he's produced 43 chances. So 4 in front of Berghuis, 5 in front of Ziyech.
That's really good.
Yeah, he's also in the top 5 for defensive actions too. So producing around the same amount as Frenkie de Jong, the CDM.
That's crazy because...
And he's playing on the right wing.
He's playing on the right wing in a 4-3-3.
He sounds a little bit Jesse Lingard-y. You know, like Jesse Lingard, when he obviously broke through and Fergie was like, you know, because of your physical nature, you won't be a first team regular till you're 23. And obviously, like you said, the photos when he's 16 to now, a massive difference. I wonder whether he's going to be a sort of late bloomer at 23.
Maybe I think a little bit more ahead of the curve than Jesse Lingard because he already looks like he's filled out. He's got quite a commanding presence on the pitch. He's languid. He's got the, like I said, he's very aesthetically pleasing to watch. And, you know, he can ride a tackle. I've watched a few highlights of him for Vitesse this season. And he loves picking up on the right, drifting into the centre of midfield. And sort of, he likes a very flat reverse ball into the box. And he should have more assists at this point in time. Can't really back that up other than having, you know, gut instinct on it because I don't have the numbers from Understat. But yeah, completing more defensive actions than, well, the same as Frenkie de Jong. I mean, admittedly, Ajax have around 10% more possession. Yeah. So Frenkie de Jong has less opportunity, I guess, to ramp those numbers up. We haven't adjusted them for possession. But that doesn't really retract from his incredible work rate, really, Odegaard. I think he's clocked on pretty quickly that now at top level football, midfielders have to be able to do everything. And this is a guy, early signs, who looks like he can do everything. He's contracted at Madrid until 2021. I think they triggered an extension, so they clearly have some faith that he's going to return to the side at some point. And he seems to have a pretty level-headed head on his shoulders. He added, you have to be modest and keep your goal in mind. How many 19-year-olds play in the first team for Madrid? The road is long and I'm convinced of myself. So that mixture of sort of self-belief, realism and modesty that I think is going to bode really well. Again, another season where he bumped up his numbers as a 20-year-old in the Dutch league. And when you're starting to, you know, when you're starting to look like a Hakim Ziyech with, you know, 5 years, when you're 5 years as junior, he's well worth, if you're a club just outside the top clubs, maybe taking on loan for a season this season.
I think, not to hammer him, but I think I personally feel like he made a mistake going to Real Madrid.
In the first place.
Is he really going to develop when he goes back to Real Madrid, or is he going to forever be struggling to get a game? Because that position, that particular position, is one of Real Madrid's most sought-after positions. You look at the likes of Isco, can't get a game in there at current. You know, they got rid of Ozil in the past to bring in other names like Gareth Bale. Is he really ever going to get in as a sort of growth player? I feel like to get into a Real Madrid side as an attacking midfielder, you've got to hit the ground with 20 goals.
Yeah, and it might work to his advantage that Solari is now the manager, and Solari was his coach in Castilla, and they've got, you know, Lucas Vasquez and Asensio aren't exactly setting the world alight. Gareth Bale's recurrent injury problems and all the stuff that, you know, that comes with this Real Madrid side that we've covered pretty extensively. So I think if ever there was a time to break into this Real Madrid side, it might be now. They've needed width for a long, long time, haven't they? Mm. Like genuine width. And he can supply that on the right. I suppose more of a hybrid playmaker.
But then they go and buy Mariano Diaz back. And it's like...
His time has been, I think it's very limited. But
I think it's a shame he's not at Real Madrid right now. Not necessarily in 6 months, because I think they'll probably get rid of Solari. But, you know, Vinicius is now getting regular minutes. Sergio Reguilón at left back's getting regular minutes. Odriozola at right back. Solari seems to have almost been like, you're established, I don't care, I want to play my young players.
It's kind of what
that's
Pep
why
Guardiola
he's not going to get the permanent job.
Yeah, probably. But it seems like a statement. Like, if he was at Real Madrid right now, I think he'd get more game time than he necessarily will next season if there's a new manager.
I think he's made very sensible career decisions post Real Madrid. I mean, as a 15, 16 year old, his family are heavily invested in you. When Real Madrid are courting you for that much money, I think it's very hard to avoid that siren call. And out of those clubs that I listed off, he'd probably be in the same predicament at most of them. I mean,
those teams,
maybe barring Bayern Munich, don't really have that a clear defined path to the first team. Dortmund sprang to my mind when I thought, you know, how does this kid, you know, profile?
But then I remember Alexander Isak going to Dortmund, what was it, 2 years ago now? Yeah. A year, because that hasn't had a sniff.
Yeah, do you remember that Tuchel didn't want him, did he? That was a really weird, fractious situation.
I think that was one of the reasons that him and Mislintat ended up falling out quite heavily, wasn't it, Alexander Isak? That Mislintat really wanted him and believed that he was going to be one of the best young strikers in the world, and Tuchel just didn't see him fitting within his own system.
It was a clash.
It was a bit of a clash. But I think Odegaard's not shot himself in the foot a little bit by going too early. But at least he's at Vitesse now. And Vitesse are big developers of young talent. You've seen some of the English boys go over there. They're like Mason Baker and Mason Mount that are doing really well now. So Vitesse is probably a great place for him to be in terms of development of young talent.
Yeah, and they're kind of, like you said, not just Chelsea's feeder club now. They are pushing for Europa League spot, and that makes all the difference. So Martin Odegaard, really barring 12 months at Real Madrid, his career trajectory has been pretty, you know, solid in terms of rising year on year. And I do think, I'm unsure as to whether he'll make it at a Real Madrid, a Barcelona, you know, a top super club. But I would definitely be sniffing around
Tottenham Hotspur.
Yeah, if I was outside that top
top
6-7 clubs in the world, 100%.
Dortmund will need a Pulisic replacement. Could be
worse. He looks like a really busy playmaker, a defensive playmaker, which are short in supply, aren't they? So let's move on now. They were our kids who have gone off the radar. We had sort of one harrowing tale, one sort of in between, I guess.
Yeah, in between. Sad and a bit.
Good to finish with the positive.
Bit of himself in the foot.
And one slightly more uplifting one. So let's go on to Rose Ed, and then we're getting into facts, where Doogie is taking us through his malfunctioning body.
Yeah, lots to come.
Our first Rose Ed comes from Joe Shepherd at Blade Thunderbolt. Cheers, he also contributed to Winners and Losers, I think, this week. So big up yourself for being active.
He's on fire.
Joe Shepherd has put football players spitting constantly. Do they realise they're rolling around in it? And I've got to say, I've never thought about it like that. And I'm a bit of a spitter on the pitch.
Mate. Do you know the funniest thing is, right? You watch a camera get onto a player. As soon as a camera's on a player, if that camera is on that player for longer than 5 seconds, he will either gob or swear 100% of the time. I've never seen a camera go onto a player where he hasn't either spat, like hawked up from his nose, like snot out of his nose, or sworn at an official. Every single time. It's vile.
It's a cesspool of spit. Isn't it?
Like, and bogeys, man. I've started to see a lot more players suddenly start to blow nose bogeys on the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, you apply a bit of Vicks to that chest, and that's streaming.
I always used to think that was just their gob. I always thought that was like...
What, they're chewing their shirt?
The Patrick Vieira was just a drooler.
I thought you just had gob on there, and Nigel Rio-Coker as well. I was like, why are they so sloppy? Why are they dribbling so much? I had no idea that it was Vicks.
Dribbling.
Yes, like, what is the idea behind the Vicks, though? Do they actually think it's like
it clears the airways? Yeah,
but does it? It's like the players that used to wear the nose bandage. Like, do they actually think that opens the airways of the nose and has any effect wearing a nose
Vicks
bandage?
Is an age old, you know, bloody. It works, doesn't it?
But why do you need to keep your nose channels like clear when you're playing football?
They'll clear immediately anyway when you're running in the fresh air.
I don't know. Let's get Patrick Vieira on the next show.
Have you ever played a football game and had a blocked nose? It's gone in seconds, mate. You're pouring out your nose.
And it tends to go down your shirt. Yeah. And hence what I thought with Vieira. Yeah.
Right, moving on from that one then, because it just descended into chaos. Next one comes from Liam Stewart, and he's asked, can we kick out the idea that you can't punish players further after a game if initial action was taken? Just a bit dense, in my opinion.
I do know what he means, though. It is frustrating. Like, if they spot a dive and give a free kick at the time, why can't he then be given a yellow?
You can with diving. Retrospective action. There's literally retrospective action.
No, but if the referee takes action at the time, you can't then punish him further. So you can't give him the diving ban.
Are you sure?
Yeah. It's only if they haven't spotted it, which is mental, in my opinion.
Yeah, that is pretty mental. I kind of agree with that. It doesn't matter if the ref spotted it or not. If TV replays show it's going to be fake, but get over it, mate. You've got 6 months of VIR come, so then it will change, won't it?
VIR.
I don't know what people are moaning about. There's no patience in the modern game anymore, is there? VAR is 6 months away. Stop moaning.
Second one then comes from Brett Millen, and he's put, when a club hires a former player as their new manager and the phrase, he knows the club, gets trotted out. Everyone knows that certain clubs play a certain way. Maybe it's a non-issue, but it just feels like lazy punditry to me.
Joe, you've got to take this one, considering current circumstances.
So I don't know whether his biggest gripe is with a club hiring a former player, or just he knows the club being used to justify that hire. Let's go with both.
Yeah.
And the whole Solskjaer thing, I mean, you're kind of on the bandwagon, but what do you think to Paul Ince coming out this week and saying that he could quite easily do the job that Solskjaer has done? Him and the boys, what are the names did he trot out?
I believe it was Husey and Brucey.
The lads.
Of course you could, Paul. Does anybody remember Paul Ince's managerial career? Yeah, that went really well. Look, less said about Paul Ince, the better. It's just absolute arrogant rubbish, isn't it, saying that he could come in and do what Solskjaer's done, because Solskjaer's actually done a really good job. But equally, I do partially see where, I can't remember the commenter's name, apologies,
Brett
is coming from, in that it is lazy journalism when players come back and old pundits go, oh, he knows the club, doesn't he? He knows the league. That's definitely lazy journalism. But I do think there is some credence to former associates of a club going back to that club when it's struggling. There's just something that happens where you see it a lot
I don't want to say it's because they know the club. Maybe it's because they've already got an outstanding relationship with members of the board, or whether it's they've got an outstanding relationship with the players that actually respect them, like they weren't respecting the previous manager. Knows the club is kind of a blanket statement when it should really be broken down to has a strong relationship with a particular individual, is a better man motivator, has a good relationship with the board that's not going to cause any frictions behind the scenes and allow training sessions to run easier. At some level, it's got some credence, but it's too much of a blanket statement, I'd agree. But in terms of old players coming back to clubs, it's kind of as and when, for case-by-case basis, isn't it? Sometimes it works, sometimes it's a horrible mess.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I don't actually think it's really necessarily even about the fans or the players or knowing the club in that way. I think it's more to do with if the fans are instantly on your side because you were a club legend, it instantly improves the atmosphere at games. And people forget that atmosphere at games does make a massive difference to players. The atmosphere you play in, you know, you can see it at Goodison Park at the moment. They're almost scared of the atmosphere because it is turning a bit iffy. But yeah, the idea that they know the club. I mean, every club has a training ground, a few pitches and an office. It's not rubbish. As if it's difficult to walk into a new environment and get to know it. But it does improve, you know, the club standing if you're instantly, you know, if the fans are instantly behind you.
Yeah.
And it gives you more time, I think, as well, which is also crucial.
Reading a book at the moment called The Club, which is so, so good, by the way. I highly recommend it. It's just about the formation of the Premier League and how like David Dean at Arsenal was so pivotal to... It's not just him, multiple figures, some really interesting figures as well throughout Premier League history that have kind of turned it into this commercial beast. But really interesting to hear that teams like Blackburn were training on a park as early as like the mid-90s. Yeah. Chelsea were renting it off a university or something.
Really?
Into like the mid to late 90s.
Well, you know Wimbledon. So I don't know if people have listened to Quickly Kevin, but if you haven't already and you like 90s football or anything like that, go and listen to Quickly Kevin because it's one of the best podcasts going. But you know Wimbledon were obviously very synonymous early days of the Premier League, came off the back of winning and becoming one of the biggest underdogs in FA Cup history when they beat Liverpool with crazy game versus the Culture Club. Wimbledon, right up until sort of 92, never arranged anything on an away day. So they would arrange the hotel and then they would turn up and they would go up to the reception of the hotel and say, where's the nearest local park? And then they'd go down and play in the park.
In terms of training beforehand.
Training on an away day. They would never go, like, they would, at no stage did they ever go, yeah, we're going to book this franchise and book this pitch before we head up. They just go, yeah, where's the local park?
Yeah.
But how embarrassing. And tells one story of the manager at the time, actually. Tells one story of Dennis Wise doing free kick practice on the right wing, whipping balls into Laurie Sanchez. And Dennis Wise whips a ball into Laurie Sanchez and he gets up, climbs, absolute towering header, bang, in off the crossbar, looks at his face, massive smear of dog shit all over his face where Dennis Wise has whipped the ball in, dog shit on the ball. Laurie Sanchez looks Dennis Wise across the pitch, straight after him like a greyhound, because Wimbledon obviously didn't mess about back then, they just used to fight each other. Dennis Wise onto the coach, gets on the coach, drives all the way back to the hotel on the coach in order to escape Laurie Sanchez and leaves the entire team 4 miles away the night before a game. The team had to walk 4 miles back to the hotel.
It wouldn't be a man you wanted to double cross. Yeah, I mean, we should probably do like early Premier League stories as a podcast. I think that could be really funny because, I mean, there's some stuff in this book in The Club that is so revealing. Like Jack Warner, you know, when Blackburn won the league, stopped the sort of monopoly of Liverpool and Arsenal. Maybe United around that period, yeah. He had to donate steel from his own company to like complete the stadium. Bradford, when they came up, giving Cabrone like 40k a week to stay up. They literally owned nothing. Bradford, in order to stay up, licensed everything they owned out to other companies and then rented it back. Or sold it to other companies and rented it back. So they didn't even own the carpets. There was like, they didn't own the windows, like stationaries, absolutely ridiculous around that era. And this is Manchester United, for example, gave Busby, as a parting gift, Matt Busby, a 20-year lease on the gift shop. And Edwards, who was second youngest CEO, I think, in Premier League history when he came in, and he really started to turn Manchester United into the iteration that we currently understand, this very commercially minded club. He was... he found out that the Busby's owned this the gift shop, and he had to pay like 200k to get it back, and he only had 2 years left on the lease. And then when he went into Manchester United's commercial department, he saw that the coaches and the kit men were organising the kit deals. So he brokered one with Admiral. That was the Man United's like the first time they were paid for a kit deal. And what else happened? Just some stories around then, just unbelievable.
Love it.
Man United's shop, I think, had one person, and it was mail order. And this is like mid-90s.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Or honestly, early 90s.
I can't implore people enough to go and listen to Quickly Kevin, Can He Score? The Paul Merson podcast on Arsenal in the 90s is one of
the best
podcasts. You know, he just used to sit there. It was him. Was it Gazza? I can't remember. It might have been Gazza. Somebody like that. It might have been Tony Adams. He used to sit at home. And they used to have a bottle of red wine, a packet of sleeping pills, and they always used to put £100 on the table. Merce, another player, and his brother, and they used to take a sleeping pill on the every half an hour whilst they're drinking red wine. And the first and the last one to fall asleep took the money.
Quality.
Oh my goodness.
They're playing professional football with the 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, so they're not doing it for the money. They're doing it to pass the time there, aren't they?
So funny, honestly. It's such a great podcast. I can't stop listening to it.
Well, talking of funny insight, let's move on to facts with Rafa Benitez. Diggy, over to you.
It's a fact. Facts.
Right, okay. This is my second time on Facts with Rafa Benitez, and I like to introduce a theme. And the theme of my last one was things I did in employment. It was all these tough times. Just a few times I've been sacked recently, which we won't cover because, you know, you then went and abused my former employer. So we'll move off that anyway. But this theme for this one is things that are medically wrong with me. And I've got a fair few things that I thought I'd like to bring to the table. And obviously, the usual system.
What? Wow. That
wow.
Outrageous.
You get out of here, Hamill. Right. So in the usual system, we're doing one truth and two lies, which is the Joe and my method, but Hamill always struggles with that. So you're looking for one truth.
One truth, yeah.
So the first one is that I am in fact partially deaf.
Oh, could be very true.
The second one is I have a hormone imbalance and I've got unnaturally high levels of testosterone. The third one is I have nocturnal lagophthalmos. Oh, I could never really say this name, even when I was told it was diagnosed.
Probably
lagophthalmos, which basically means that I sleep with my eyes partially open.
Oh, right. My mate's got that. Terry Ryan, shout out, sleeps with his eyes fully open.
Yeah, my girlfriend assures me I do that as well.
Creepiest
and
thing
also
ever
laugh,
seen.
Which is pretty weird.
Anyway,
but
yeah, it's caused me a few issues in the past.
Let's go back to number one because I mean he's. Always being surprised may being partially deaf may explain why he's always surprised.
Yes. Mm. He is the jumpiest man ever.
Yeah.
So he could well be. If you go up behind Doogie and literally tap him on the shoulder, it's like an earthquake.
It's like he's on his last nerve.
Anyone who hasn't watched Joe's first YouTube video.
He's on his last nerve every
single
time.
How old were you when you were diagnosed with lack of hearing?
So I was actually, I think I was telling Hamill the other day or someone in the office, I basically, when I was 5 or 6, was in sort of preschool, pre-prep. And for some reason, we were having popcorn in that day, and I decided
got
to
a bit
do
stuck in your ears.
A science experiment about whether you could hear with popcorn seeds in your ear. So I shoved popcorn seeds down my ear, and turns out that you can't hear much. And went home that night
still there
and
now.
Was like, "Mum, I've got something to tell you." I'd waited hours to tell her because I thought I was going to get told off. And she was like, "What is it?" And I was like, there's popcorn seeds in my ears. So she had to put olive oil down there. And one of them came out. One of them
stuck your head in the microwave.
One of them came out. Yeah, it's lucky it wasn't a warm day that day. One of them came out and the other one didn't. So I had to then have an operation the next day in Ninewells, which is a hospital in Dundee. And they basically like screwed into my ear at the back. It was a really painful operation. And had to remove the popcorn seeds. And ever since then, my hearing's never really been the same. I don't know whether you guys have ever noticed, but I have to do quite a lot of mouth reading when people speak to me. Like, I really don't hear very well. And if I get headphones on, often in the office, we're editing, so we're wearing these huge headphones, which pretty much are noise-cancelling for most people. But for me, I can't hear a fucking thing. So people can scare me at
is
the
that
easiest
why
opportunity.
You've got like unbelievable focus? It's just because you can't hear the rabble in the background?
Yeah, there's nothing going on.
Right, fair play.
It's just me
so
and the
which ear was it they drilled into?
It was the right one.
Wow.
And it was because you got a bit of popcorn. So at what stage when you're sat in class, was it an actual legit class science experiment where you just turned your
No, 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 I was just doing... No, they weren't encouraging us to do it. I was just messing around. everyone gets some popcorn in your ears. No.
Stick your popcorn
in
your ear.
So I was quite a curious child, I should say. And not I wasn't a weirdo, but I was curious to learn. And I was probably a bit strange as well. But anyway, those popcorn seeds went in and only one came out. Led to an operation and here
in
I
no
am.
Other no other orifices. See, no, because we all know you've got a gaping. No,
it feels a little bit to me like would they? I mean, operation the next day seems drastic. That's like to get an operation.
That's an emergency operation. Yeah,
real emergency operation.
I mean, that's a good shout. And this is so believable that I almost feel it could be false. The level of detail in there was absolutely excellent. It does definitely relates to what we know about him in real life. It
doesn't feel like he would have had an operation to remove a popcorn seed.
I also like, is it just the hearing in that ear then that's off?
Yeah, it's just in that ear, yeah. I don't know whether it's hereditary as well, because my dad didn't have very good hearing either, but it's certainly, I've got appalling hearing for a 24-year-old going on 25.
I feel like he would have told us this before. The amount of times I've scared him.
Yeah,
it's not something I'm particularly, I know I'm coming out with it now, but it's not something I really like people to know about, because I always think people will give me, you know, special dispensation, which I don't really need.
Why? Because you put a popcorn scene near.
Well, no, because I can't hear very well. And it does affect me sometimes playing sport when you get calls from different directions.
It's like one of the few things you do need special dispensation for, though. Like, people should be shouting at you like a little bit. I think that was good. That was compelling. But I almost felt like this second one is so
obvious
misleading that it could be true.
Yeah,
testosterone though, yeah, so yeah, increase your hair production, doesn't
hormone
it?
Hormone imbalance. Yeah, well, basically, I'll give you a bit of background. I was about 19 at this time, and I've always been, when I play sport, I get incredibly sweaty, and I also started, you know, it's turned
I'm not surprised. It looks like, for anyone, you know, that's not seen without a top, and it looks like he's wearing a bath mat
exactly. Yeah, the best chest in the west is what you always call me. Anyway,
literally never.
And I started losing my hair at like 19 anyway, and my mum was like, I think you might have an overactive thyroid. Turns out that the hair was for something completely different, because she was like, you can't control your temperature and you're losing your hair. And she Googled it, which is the worst thing to do. She's like, right, Doogie, we need to get you checked out. So I went down to the local hospital and had a few tests, and they were like, no, you don't, your thyroid's all fine, but you've got abnormal levels of testosterone, which will effectively mean you'll be, you know, you'll lose your hair really early and you'll look like a bear for your entire life, effectively.
You must be a popular figure down there by now.
Yeah, yeah. These are about 13 years apart.
Right, popcorn bear freak.
So, yeah, it was just one of those things I've had to deal with. It doesn't make life difficult. I'll just be bald at 28 and I'll just be really hairy.
I haven't noticed you get disproportionately sweaty, though.
Yeah, no, I do get
pretty
hot.
I've seen him get pretty damn hot.
You know, in the summer, you might not remember, but I used to come down from the VO booth absolutely dripping.
Yeah, in that Sunderland shirt with the low V-neck.
Yeah, it's pretty hot.
Old Reg Vardy.
Yeah.
Is it? I mean, that one doesn't surprise me, but I feel like there may be some details that he's tweaked in there that make it a lie.
I mean, he's got tangible evidence that could be true. So that's why I feel it's too obvious.
Incredibly
it's
hairy.
Literally is. It's staring us in the face.
Yeah.
I can feel it. I can almost feel his hair.
Okay. What was the third one again?
And the third one was, I've got nocturnal lagothalamus. There it goes. Got it right that time, which basically means that I sleep with my eyes permanently, well, partially open.
Yeah, I do have friends that have this disorder, but I don't know.
When
it feels like you've just Googled that.
Yeah, when would you have had that diagnosed?
So it was a bit concerning once, only because I basically got misunderstood about what was going on. Basically, I was about 9 or 10, and I obviously hadn't had a girlfriend at this stage, I might have had a girlfriend at that stage, not a serious girlfriend, so I hadn't like shared a bed with anyone. So no one had watched me sleep.
But your mum and dad surely came in to check on you nearly every night as a child. You know, they didn't just put you down and go, yeah, fuck him.
They clearly weren't.
If he dies in his sleep, don't worry about swaddling.
They clearly weren't caring about me very much. Maybe it's something I developed later. Anyway, I fell asleep on a long haul flight. I think we were going on holiday to, well, it's not even that long haul flight. We're going to Italy. And I fell asleep onto this woman. But because my eyes were open, she thought I died. So she then alerted the pilot or told
alerted the pilot. She went straight to the pilot.
She told
pilot. She fucked off the stewardess.
I've slightly exaggerated that for podcast benefit. She told the stewardesses and my parents, and everyone was like,
"Your kid's dead."
And then
mum
looked at me and was like, "Oh no, no, no! He always does that." So I've always done it. Right. But why didn't she just go,
"Are you all right?"
Well, yeah. She just saw these glassed eyes of a child looking back at her.
No, I she wouldn't go straight to death.
I don't think she wouldn't go straight. I don't even think she'd go straight to stewardess. I think you'd go, "You're right, mate," and he'd go, "Yeah."
As soon as she feels his head resting on her, he gets a little shrug, because it's not just a short journey, is it? It's not a short journey. You're getting like
a 2.5 hour flight.
Yeah, you're not drooling on me for the next 2.5 hours.
So I think Ferb one's off.
I also think that's the one where he's dropped a scientific condition name in there.
I think it's one of the first overkill. Tempted to say the popcorn, you know. Although what I would say is there's less detail in the second one, so he could have changed more detail in the first. It might not have been popcorn, it could be a sunflower seed.
He's played this well here, because he's given us he's the first one is sort of I feel like the second one's screamingly obvious, but the first one is nice.
I reckon maybe Grace has the eye open disorder, something like that, where she sleeps with her eyes open.
Well, we know he's a pretty proactive sleeper, and I think a lot of people like sleep with their eyes open, but it's not like a significant condition where you go and explore why. Yeah,
you just know it's.
I think I know the popcorn story happened. Does he know that we know that happened, and as a result?
But this is my thing. He might well have changed a detail. Like I feel a popcorn story happened, but I don't think they would have operated in 24 hours to drill into your head and get that popcorn seed out.
Yeah, so the truth we're looking for,
I think the truth is 2.
I also think the truth is 2.
So we're going to go the truth is 2, please, Douglas.
Correct.
Yeah!
Well played. Yeah, the third one was like complete rubbish. Just I needed a third thing that was wrong with me. I couldn't think of anything. The popcorn seed I did put in my ear, did actually have an operation, but I'm not partially deaf. I think I do have quite bad hearing, or I am just maybe focused when I'm working, but I can't hear anything in the office. And then, I do have a hormone imbalance, and I've got unnatural levels of testosterone, according to my doctor.
Oh, we pretty much called that exactly.
Yeah, so you absolutely smashed it. Well done, lads.
Superb detective work there from Sherlock Holmes and Watson.
Who's Sherlock? Who's Watson?
From Ron and Harry.
Definitely Watson.
Philosopher's Stone-esque work. Right, that's it for another week of Sunday Vibes Extra Time. Thank you very much for listening. Suggest your ideas for future podcast episodes on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube comments. You know the rates by now. And apart from that, enjoy the rest of your Sunday, guys. Look out for winners and losers tomorrow morning, as well as Euro Roundup on Eurofootball Daily. Goodbye.
Thanks, guys.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Don't forget to check out Now TV's Sky Sports Mobile Month Pass for just £5.99. For more information on the Mobile Month Pass, just search Now TV Sport.